Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 9th, 1998, in the Koinonia Fireside Room. This evening is Walt Wongren, Jr. Today's session number is 98-8, and it's titled A Christmas Collection, Original Carols and Pieces. Let's listen in.
Evening, to introduce to you Walt Wongren, a pastor, teacher, writer, and artist. Walt has been writing for many years. He learned to type actually in the third grade and wrote his first novel in the eighth grade. I don't think that one's published though, is it?
No.
Since then he's written 24 books of pastoral theology, short stories, children's stories, and novels. One of these, The Book of the Dun Cow, won the prestigious American Book Award, and the New York Times called it the best children's book of the year. Tonight he will share with us a collection of carols and pieces dealing with Advent and Christmas, all of which have a sense of music to them. In fact, they may soon be set to music. In Walt's words, these carols will show for us what flesh means against the pressure of the cross. So let's welcome Walt Wongren.
First thing I want to do is set you free. That is to say that when you've had enough, leave. That's okay. I don't mind at all. This is, for me, as much a pleasure and a gift from you to me as it is anything from me to you. And I'm very serious about that. How this came about, that is to say, this particular reading and this manuscript. In the spring of this year, actually beginning, I would say, about February, I wrote the drafts for two books. The first book was a book of devotions for Advent. I've written a devotional book for Lent called Reliving the Passion. And the publisher has been knocking and knocking ever since then, saying, why not Advent? And so I did. But just the whole issue of Advent, plus the fact that I think about Christmas all the time. I don't always choose to think about it, and it's not always nice when I think about it, but I think about it all the time, both as a ritual event and as an event of revelation, as something to conjure with the issue, this whole business of that a deity should somehow or other become manifest. When I was done with the Advent book then, I began to put together pieces which resulted from this long, long thought that I've done. Among the pieces that I did are, the book right now is called, and so I finished the second manuscript, that's the point. I finished it just days, actually the day before we took off to lead some stuff in Alaska and come here. I brought the manuscript with me in order to work on it. It's not done. That's your kindness. What you're going to hear is unfinished. That's also your gentleness, I hope. Things unfinished are really, they're sort of hard to show forth. I'll get back to that in a minute. And so this is made up of stories. I call them carols, and some of them will sound very much like carols. Others are sheer poetry, so I call them canticles. Reflections, and altogether right now I'm simply calling it a Christmas collection. I fired it off to my agent, brought this with me to work on, and lo, Mark Cedio was here last week, who is a man of incomparable qualities with music, playing, and composition. So we sat down and I read through the parts of this book which have the potential for musicking, whether they're singing or whether there'd be some grand music behind it. I read them to him. And it looks like we might fool around for a while and see what happens. This is one of my great pleasures as a writer, is to fool around with the other arts, the visual arts, the musical arts, the dramatic arts. And so he said, could he please have a recording of my reading these things? You notice I didn't say me reading these things. I said my reading these things. And so I went to, who did I talk to? Dorothy Bass, and I said, I'd like to read this one time on recording. She said, oh, why don't you invite the people? You are the people, and you are doing me a great kindness to allow me to read this. Let me take a step backward, the part that I just skipped over. Some of you may know of Kathleen Norris, who has written Dakota and just has come out with a third book in the sequence. She's not suddenly very filled with words. She's been writing for a long, long time in South Dakota. I spent some time with her once when I was speaking at a monastery, the very one that you may read about in Cloister Walk. And I dared to tell a story from a novel I was writing, and she was the one person who really understood what a dangerous thing it was I was doing. novel wasn't done. It was a centerpiece story. It's from now, The Crying for a Vision, which I read to the kids today. And I took such pleasure in sitting and talking with her about when things are ready. But we both agreed that sometimes it's possible to read things unready to communities that have a breath of listening, where they don't come diving in on as it is, but honor its gestation, its borning possibility. And that's what this is. It's kind of a borning thing. Then finally to tell you, because this is music stuff, you may hit a surfeit as I read. And I can get to prose later on. I don't think it's going to take a terrible long time to read through this, and I'm going to go slowly at it. But that's when you are free, and I really meant that. If you've heard enough of carols and you have to rack your brain, in my book these are not going to come in a block like this. They're going to come separate. You'll have the interlinear business of the storytelling, which is always easier in some cases. But I'll talk about these a little bit as we go, and then you see how you feel, and when you're ready to go, go. What else was I going to say? Well, they're not all sweet, and you might begin to listen to a repetition of imagery. The first one, it opens the book. It's called Sing Softly the Cherries. Let me read it and I'll say a word or two about it. This one does have a sort of carol feel, but if you listen closely, there'll be a minor chord. Can carols have minor chords? Sing softly the cherries, red, red, sweet and good. Sing apples and oranges, the cinnamon food. Dance swiftly the cider, spin more than you should, for liquor and laughter will lighten your load. Declaim the roast turkey and riddle the sauce. Potatoes are stories of riches and loss. Pipe merrily, carrots, drum beats till they bleed. They root down to darkness who started as seed. Oh, candy the greetings you give to your guests. The wassail is fleeting and life ends in death. So taffy your handshake and ginger the kiss. Bake huggings like muffins, a brave Eucharist. Be feast for my Christmas and I'll be your food. Beg Christ to assist us in everything. Well, I like the synesthesia. I just like playing suddenly with the whole idea that food could become everything. Absolutely everything. And this is, I mean, that's carol quality because in its simplicity it has the lines and the line breaks exactly as music might do that. Some of you are musicians here and hear music behind things. Yeah. Well, that'll open it, and actually it opens up the first section of the book is going to be called Angels. And the whole idea is, I mean, the piece that follows it immediately is a sort of a begging for an annunciation of angels. I wish that I were. I do sometimes wish that I were Mary. I wouldn't mind for this absolutely incontrovertible presence of the Holy somewhere, you know, where it bursts forth, flames in front of you, and you can't say that it didn't happen. This is an Advent poem. It has two parts. The first part is much more dramatic, and as we talked about it, Mark and I, you can see music behind it and a declamatory voice in the front. It start, stops, but if you allow your imagination, I hope that not just your eyes, but your ears will see this. I'm calling it a canticle right now, which isn't altogether true. Canticles come out of Scripture. It's called Angels of Advent, Part 1. In the days of the angels, the hair on the necks of the people, didn't it stand like a static? In the days of the angels, the air at their ears, the cloud in the heavens, didn't it crack like a solid? In the days when the angels dropped, discharging news to the troposphere, could such electric language not have shot the nerves of the firmament with signs? Signs, white words and understanding? Skin, the abdomen, and deep the human womb must have been tympanic then. Ho, in the days when archangels spoke, wasn't the scent of the weather ozone, tasting of seltzer and ions? And the look of the air thereafter, wasn't it crystalline, cleaner, dimensioned by nitrogen oxides? even as somebody's breathing swells with well-being, wasn't the breeze of the evening green? Surely the people perceived that angels were imminent, speaking. A son. Now there is a bolt to strike an old man dumb. 100 bidders in the courtyard, Jews devout at the hour of incense, should have been shocked in their nostrils, charged by a nitrogenous excitement, their blood a rush of bubbles. A son, let a maiden grab her skirts and run. Let citizens stare after her, stunned, wondering why modesty goes forking through the streets, her knees indecently aflame. Her hair unpinned, a fume on the wind. Cousin, cousin, I've such a thing to tell you. A virgin son. And the father who had not engendered it sprang from his pillow, the crack of prophecy still ringing in his ears. Surely Nazareth was startled with that man. Surely Galilee, surely Rome, at such an impossible pop of lightning, moaned in her sleep. A savior. Then all the stars, the wheeling galaxies stream down, exploding songs of fire across the firmament, sheeting the fields of the shepherds in a flaming rain, Gloria roaring, Gloria in Altissimus Deo, the storm of heaven striking earth, all angels in a fusillade. Could anyone have stayed asleep when the whole air burned electric blue and every hair on every head was singed? Well, if they did, they smelled the smoke in the morning and did not understand it was themselves whom God had scorched. But the leaves grew greener in their season. The vines were nourished by the nitrogen. Oh, grapevines comprehend an angel's discharge. And vineyards that year produced a wine so red that fools who lifted glasses to the sun were made uneasy by the crimson lens and the dim suspicion they were drinking blood. So, have any of you, there's part two to come, but have you been raised in the Midwest? Yes, and you know what the lightning storms do, especially in the evening? What that nitrogen does? Well, that keeps going through my mind. I think these angels coming down. On the other hand, this is an Advent piece. Some of you were here still last week, and you maybe heard Larry Rasmussen talking about the gospel of the earth. So this is part two. But the salmon, shooting from a shattered water, knows. And the falcon on her shelf of wind, the blink before she stoops. And the doe, who suddenly lifts her face from a bank of fern, twisting her ears like dishes. And the prairie dogs, all standing watch on the tableland, erect as pepper shakers. And the ant, twiddling her feelers in the universe. And the rabbit, caught in the gloaming of the cougar. And the krill, upheaving on the advent of ocean water that precedes the gray whale. All of these, at the terminal nerves of their beings, know Kairos. The fullness of time, that the storm of the Lord is at hand. They long for the crack of liberty of all creation, groaning an intensity of wakefulness. They have unsullied senses. Watch them, call them kin. O ye nations, let these be your angels. Well. Now I feel like I should just lean back and tell a story. I really ought to. And this is a lot to take in at a time. Are you all right yet?
Yep.
Yes. I've never done this before, this whole sequence of stuff like that.
I thought Edmund was more quiet, you know.
What?
I thought Edmund was more quiet.
More quiet?
I like it this way.
You like it like that?
I like it this way.
Oh, you like it this way?
Yeah.
Oh, good. And you know, I mean, when I travel to universities, very often I will read stories or tell stories because I feel more alert
to the group that's here, and stories allow there to be a kind of a dialogue. When I tell a story, it always grows organically with the people that are here. 3 days ago, I told a story about my son, Matthew, and the cross burning. And because some of you were here, perhaps, because the group was so genial unto me, I was able to play issues in that story I had never done before. That's the sweet organic life of a story. It's also the best way, you know, to speak things that we consider to be most true, because they have this immediacy of living. You do poetry, and actually it's a very slow, it's like the growing of trees, poetry. You look at it and there it is, and you can't come back 15 minutes later and see much of a change.
Yeah.
It grows so slowly, and so what it is at a time you hear. This is a different sort of piece then. This is not Carol-like. I call it Wherefore White. I do come from a liturgical tradition, and it makes me, I mean, and the blessing of it is that it grants me all kinds of symbols, wordless symbols to think in. So I'm going to talk about the white that happens at Christmas. I'm thinking of, as Roman Catholics, you know, the stole is white, and the Lutherans likewise, and Episcopalian and so forth. I'm grateful for that. Let me just say two things around that. My Lutheran heritage granted me so much sweetness and breadth of symbol, except they were almost not verbal symbols. Just a thought. And I'm verbal. And I wrote my stories. I went through the whole system to become a pastor in the Missouri Synod, and I wrote stories, and they kept waiting for me to get out of that stage. I was telling Chris this, you know, because you write stories and there's always ambiguity in it. But you know, in the Protestant mind, words should mean just one thing. So if I were a musician, they'd let me get away with ambiguity. If I were a painter, I could get away with it, you know, and the colors and the stoles and the beauty of our architecture, but let us put words together. Yes, yes, he'll get around. He'll be a good theologian one day. So, this is the... forgive me, but I'll tell you, I love this piece. I love the development of it. One or two words yet. This, if not for you, it's for Mark. Hello, Mark. If you have read Anne Sexton's poetry, you know that she plays a long, long line. Do any of you know her?
Oh, God.
Please, if you don't know her, know this woman. Know Anne Sexton. She's extraordinary because she genuinely is searching for things, and she'll play different. She plays a long line that I took from her, but she took it from Christopher Smart, this poet back in the Victorian times. Mad Kit Smart, they call him. Mad Christopher Smart writes a beautiful poem about his cat Jeffrey and how his cat Jeffrey turns around 7 times a day to praise the Lord. Kit Smart was so smart in understanding how animals and nature declare unto God the glory of the firmament and all that, that everyone was afraid of him except Samuel Johnson, who said that if everyone were as mad as Kit Smart were, the world would be sane. So he writes this long, long line, which comes through Anne Sexton to me. And if you'll allow it, then just allow, I'll read each one relatively slow. You must both see, hear, remember, feel, all that stuff with each one, and you'll find that they build as they go. But the whole issue is why white? Wherefore white? For that the lily candidum, Madonna's lily, when it opens to the daily Gabriel of the sun, is white, and it is good as God did still to start with Mary. Ave gratia plena. For that virginity awaiting yet its script, some word to make a sense of it, has ever been as white as an unwritten sheet, but God sends purpose to the possibilities. Hail, thou greatly favored one. For that the Holy Spirit, come low to overshadow her, was whiter than the piling cloud, a vapor of the deity, the wind and breath of God. For that humility is colorless and purity it's shining, and these Maria was when Ecce said, Ecce ansela Domini, I, the handmaid of the Lord, say fiat, let it be. Remember that word fiat, remember. For that the snow which cloaks this season, covering the party-colored tantrums of humanity, in one hue only, cool and smooth, is white. For that white is all the colors in chromatic harmony, precise equality, fusion's unity, and there was one babe only and one God above us.
For that white is the innocence of the infant, the nimbus darting from his face. For that the glory that shone round the shepherds was unquenchable, a white flame from the throne of God. For that the stars who next threw down their spears to sing above the midnight of our fears were white. For that their song was et in terra pax, peace, the pleading of the stars, and the figure of peace is a dove, and the dove is white. For that if wars should cease on one day, the next day's dawning would be white as fleece. For that the eyes of all are whiter than the skins of any. For that the holy deed remembered in this season admits of no division, none other instrument than God's pure love alone, no human help, though humans have the benefit. And the Father's first word was Fiat Lux, the primal light. And the Father's best word was Filius Meus, son beloved. And the Father's full love, Lux Mundi, light of the world, is likewise white. For that I cried when I knelt with treasures for the child, a single tear. And lo, my tear meant more to him than myrrh, which tear he wore upon his breast, when down to sorrows, down to death, down under the load of this world he went. Which tear, when he arose, was diamond, fire white at the heart of it. For that the teeth of children, when they laugh, are ivory, and their laughter is a pearl. Therefore do we at Christmas drape our holy furniture and stole the necks of those who preach in white. It's a long one. I wish I had something with which you could cleanse your brainy palate, your brain's palate. Well, enjoy this one. This one I mean to be a carol, and this one I also, you know, the Book of the Duncow is a musical now. And we've done it, we workshopped it two summers ago with an extraordinary director which helped us. We put it on at Valparaiso last year, and this year we're gonna put it on at the University of Evansville. Each one of these makes it better and better. The fellow who wrote the music for this is a man named Randy Quartz. He and Mark St. Germain have done several off-Broadway pieces, some of which are still done. In fact, are done often. They did one called The Gift of the Magi that I saw was being done in Minneapolis last time I was there. Randy writes the music, and he's writing one for this. I'm calling this the Carol of All Instruments. And he has begun to tell me how each of these instruments he can use as sort of background. So perhaps if you're looking for some kind of a pageant that you would enact, that children could act in, with a new verse each time as it moves from their sleep, actually to the manger, and then home again, this would be the one. It's called the Carol of All Instruments. Whistle on wooden pipes, wake the children, plead on the wailing reed that the children arise and come. Organ, send forth a chord, through the morning and their sleeping, pour in their souls the gold of the light of the rising sun. Bugle, oh bugle the news, last night, midnight, stall and stable, bells, bells, declaim the news, lo, a baby is born, a son. Bass drum and snare drum march, straight to stable, leading children, sounding their footfalls march, that the baby can hear them come. Gabriel, greet them now. Whisper welcome, all ye children. Angels ignite the sky with the fires of a midnight crown. Orchestras, angels, choirs, it's getting louder. Razor roaring, glory, glory. Children, now round your mouths to give praise in 10,000 tongues. King and his crown are here, born in glory, cradled poorly. Baby shall grow to bear on his forehead the thrones of wrong. Jesus, one flute alone, silver singing, sings to children, flute of five stops his song. I will love you till day is done. Love you until that night, night of dying, dies and rising. Then in the holy dawn, I will bear you, my children, home. In my bosom, the whole way home. Although I imagine spaces between the verses. Do you have a question or a thought? Anything I would respond to? Oh, my children.
Walt, I will say that you evoke a very holy mystery that is just like a warm light.
Good. Well, I'm going to move one a little forward here. This is a harder one. And if I can explain it, I wouldn't have written it, I suppose. I'm calling it Birth 3 in Eucharist. And it has two parts to it. And the second part just overwhelms me. And it says something true beyond my ability to say it any other way. The first actually is very much in a carol form, and it uses from early English, Middle English ballads, a phrase that you find again and again in Terra Canant Angeli. It means in the earth the angels sing. In Terra Canant sing, third person plural, Angeli, angels. But this too is a part of my understanding of Christmas. This is just 1, 2, 3, 4 verses first, but I'll read it slowly. Jesus was born with hair, with needle teeth, a milk blue breath, four paws walking and aware. A natal song we sing for thee in Terra Canant Angeli. Mary his mother licked all lovingly his roomy eye with a doting tongue and quick. And lullabies we murmur thee in Terra Canant Angeli. Flesh of the flesh of beasts, creation's ward that was its Lord, born to meet and host our feasts, astonished hymns and litanies in Terra Canant Angeli. Cub of creation, go, break from thy den, run among men, cross our cold midwinter snow, and prove what sort of beasts we be in Terra Canant Angeli, et lamentatur Archangeli. Lament, weeping archangels. And then this is the, you do a, when the Greek chorus comes on, you know, it sings walking one way, and then it sings going the other way. So this is the strophe as it comes on singing. And then you have an antistrophe as they go back to sit down again. That was the strophe. This is the antistrophe, and it contains in it one of the images that I find I cannot turn away from. We'll talk about it when I'm done. This is the sort of poem where each line is specifically four syllables. Each of the verses begins with lines that are a little bit longer, but then you have only four syllables, and it's meant to be stopped at the end of each line. It's not rhyming, you'll see. And I'll just read it, and then I'll tell you what. And the wolf. How did they kill the wolf? Slit a salt lick, grind a deep groove, etch a sheath, slip the blade within, this sheath, edge up and pack the crack. But the wolf, how did they kill the wolf? He ran his tongue like a muslin of flesh across the salt, drool from joints in his tongue, numbed the tongue cuts. How did they kill the wolf? His drooling dropped blood. Blood he lapped. Blood he hungered, Lord, so fiercely his stomach seized at warm, rich blood. The wolf? The wolf bled forth his food, swallowed, gulped, and did not know he was his prey. He praised God that all he wished he had. Oh, you blessed block of sweet blood. The wolf he drained and drank his life by the self-same lacerated, howling organ. Speak to me, speak to me, speak to me. How did they kill the wolf? Did they kill the wolf? Did they know he craved, did he know he craved his own blood? If you don't mind, I'm going to pause over that a little bit. To me, this is all bound together in birth and Eucharist and the bearing blood and the blood. This is an image which is true.
And I remember the first time that I read it, it seemed to me one of the profound ironies of this existence. That one of the ways in which they trap wolves in the north, this I used a block of salt for, and that's a little bit off, is that they'll take a knife and they'll wrap it in tallow, in thick whale fat or something like that. But they'll leave just the tip of the knife above the tallow. And then they'll dig a hole, and they'll make the hole flat on the bottom, and with strings they'll hang that tallow into the hole and fill it with water. When the water freezes, with the strings also still in the water, what they have then is a block of ice. A block in which is the tallow, which is above the ice, and which is the knife, which is above the tallow. On the strings that are frozen into it, they'll carry it out where they find a wolf run, where they see the scats and the presence of a wolf, and they'll just leave it there. And in the winter, as the wolves are having difficulty looking for food, you know, they'll come upon that tallow and begin to lick it. And when they lick it, of course, the knife cuts their tongue. And then they become very hungry because what they're eating is their own. And that's an irony I can't get my brain around. That they're feeding upon their own blood and they're hungry for their own blood. And the curious thing is that a trap like this somehow or other creates this horrible circumstance where people think that what they're feeding on, which is so good, they think what they're feeding on is so good, but what it is their very life. They're eating their life. And that's that irony of, which just blows me. His drooling dropped blood, bloody lap, blood so he hungered so fiercely his stomach. The wolf bled forth his food, swallowed, gulped, and did not know he was his prey. He praised God that all he wished he had. Oh, you blessed block of sweet blood. And, you know, on the one hand, if you don't mind, you know, sometimes I just stand back and I look at this whole business of this birth, of the deity's birth, and then that the same deity would somehow or other shed blood and do so for love and delight, and I, what does that mean? What does that mean? Do you love the blood you're shedding? And if you love the blood, is that good? Is that bad? What kind of thing is going on here? And how is that? But, you know, there are other overtones in here. I imagine sometimes this deific birth as an explosion in the world, which is natural, like the cub of creation, as I described in the first place. And so we send forth, and so creation sends forth these bundles of glory, these bundles of complete righteousness. And here we go, you know, in our snowmobiles after them. And I know that's how they kill the coyote in the West. They'll chase that poor sucker down until it's just exhausted and cracks through the snow. And that's for fun. The other day I was golfing and I saw a person, none of this has anything to do with Christmas, and you'll forgive me, but I thought now I was golfing and I saw this guy. I walk when I golf, and this guy he's in a car and so forth and so on. He's in a cart. And I saw a groundhog. Groundhog, you know, a woodchuck, whatever you want to call it. It's a very big thing. And it doesn't run very fast. It exhausts his poor self. You know, it's like a rumpled body, you know. A groundhog is sort of like a rug you're shaking out when it's running. It goes like that. And this guy, I know he was well-heeled because of the kind of clubs he had and the way he dressed. He was perfect for the course. If I had come on without a collar, they'd have kicked me off. It's one of those courses you have to have a collar. But these men, it's okay. He belongs on there, and he's chasing this groundhog in his cart. I'm watching this poor groundhog like he's for his very life, and he's going after it. And I think, okay, what if that groundhog is the presence of God? What does that mean? That's what I think sometimes. Well, you know, and the whole issue of Christmas is the incarnation. That's the thing, this extraordinary thing, which we often see as sweetness and light. You know, little baby, and isn't that wonderful? Little baby in a manger, and I write that way. It is wonderful, and it has that sweetness about it. Here comes Jesus among us, gentle Jesus, meek and mild. Doesn't even cry a tear in some of those carols. Sure, but what does that mean when the deity takes human flesh among us, and what does that trigger in us? Or if it doesn't trigger it, what does it reveal in us? Revelation is on two sides, you know. It is on the side of God, but it's also on the side of humanity. That's how Jesus thought. Jesus said, whether it was Jesus or John, we don't know in this particular gospel what's going on, but that Jesus came into the world not to judge the world, but Jesus is the light of the world, and when that light shines on, bing, all those who love the darkness skedaddle. So it's not as if Jesus gets up there with a hammer and raps and says, you're bad, you're good, you're going to heaven, you're going to hell. All Jesus does is turn on the light. And now we have two revelations. Those who are afraid of the light and the full revelation, that burning thing, this is me, all the way down to, you know, whatever I am, naked. This is me. And those who are willing to live in the light, to become part of the light, means you go through that process of not skedaddling and loving anything else more than the light. When we lived in the inner city, We lived right smack on the corner, crossing the library in a wonderful park, but the corner where again and again people would gather and smoke dope and play their boomboxes real loud and so forth and so on, which I have to admit irritated me. These are not, I mean, you don't love everything about the inner city, you're just there. So what I did was I took a passage, I mean, took a verse from John chapter 5, which I've just described to you, and I put great big lights. It's a two-story house. I put great big lights on the corner of our house. And I put the switch in our bedroom upstairs. So that when the boombox would start, I would switch that light on. Bam! It was honestly as if from heaven, strobe lights are on. This car parked there and people were dancing. And they look up and they can't even see my house. It's so bright. It's so bright, my house is humming. They left. Behold, the light has come and my children are safe for another night. Now, all this just tracks back. I mean, one of the things that strikes me about Christmas is, I mean, we find it sweet and good because we see comfort coming totally in our way. But what I find just terrible or dangerous about Christmas is when God comes, it's not just the revelation of God, it's the revelation of people willy-nilly, whether you like it or not. You reveal yourself in those moments. And who will catch you if you run? So come up with creation. Across the Colorado snows. Little sermon.
I hope you don't mind. You know, Walt, I was pointing out one thing about the wolf one that was interesting. I saw a different thing there other than Christmas.
Yeah, good.
I saw an addicted person.
Oh, do. Yes, I hear it.
I saw that all the way through. Mm-hmm.
I hear that as well. And you know what I saw? I saw an economic society like ours where you really do train people that they love what's killing them. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't have to be just drugs. Mm-hmm. It can be any kind of, I mean, where you purchase money and you're buying things. And that's, I think, a great deal of what's behind our advertising, is to make people believe that what is their own life. I mean, you're giving up your life, but for your own, yeah, but I like that. Drugs, absolutely. Well, here's one which is not quite so harsh. I must admit again, I really like this one. And this is shaped, actually, I did a lot of reading in the border ballads, and some of you may or may not know, I mentioned this last week. My PhD work was pretty much in Middle English and Medieval English. That's why Latin is one of my languages. But I love the free way in which, that's where the cup of creation, those people were so free to see conjunctions. That freedom that you could say Jesus is like a little wolf cub born and still find beauty or something true in that, we've moved pretty much away from. But I get it from like the 8th, 9th, 10th century and then into the middle, before the Renaissance, where people were free with that sort of thing. Again and again they'd find those conjunctions. It reappears in 17th century poetry, right? John Donne, George Herbert, Richard Byrne, Crashaw, these guys. They were able to crash symbols together. Not symbols, gene. You know what I mean, don't you? Images and figures, symbols, and make them work. So this poem comes a little bit from that, but it's more tame than the one I just read you. I took a very ancient Middle English Christmas rhyme and did a little bit of change as a heading. It reads this way. Mary Maida Mildenfrey, Chambre of the Trinity, he crowned and he lore. I mean, look what they're thinking, that she is the room, the chambre of the Trinity. She's the room of the Trinity. What a wonderful image, boom. And they just, boom. But they go on and say, crowned and elor, which means lost and sorrowful. It's never just sweet. So this will be in four parts. The first one is a single heading verse, and then each of the parts after that have three verses to them. And it's the conjunction now of both the birth and the cross. You'll hear that. The briar in a dry land grows. Mary shall wear its blood-red rose. Her son shall wear the thorn. Part 2. Saint Joseph cut the cherry tree, whose fruit he gave to his lady. Then what was left? The stone. Saint Joseph cut mahogany to make the babe a crib, but he was to the manger born, to wood already worn. One father split the cedar tree and made two beams. A house, cried he, a cross the other mourned. part three. Shepherds brought wool to the royal stall, for the mother a robe, for her darling a pall, for their sleeping both cold and warm. Three gentlemen offered three measures of myrrh, a drop to perfume, a sponge to blur, a ton to embalm the Lord. And gold is lovely to the eye, but cold as stone to him who lies behind the golden door. Four. Now these, the briar and the cherry, wood and wool and gold, did Mary ponder when Christ was born. Within her heart she kept it all, a thorn, a cross, a stone, a pall, and they herself adorned. For the pain was his, but he was hers, her child, the treasure in her purse, by whom her womb was torn, et eius salvator. I think of Mary in all this. Just think of Mary, her purse. African-American women would know exactly that image about purse. They say to their daughters, and their daughters go forth, you keep your purse closed. Or they say sometimes pocketbook. Keep your pocketbook closed. There's another birth one. I have two more. No. Three more. This is, you're going to hear some words. It's very rhythmic poetry, but I'm not going to read it rhythmically. So it'll be like talk between the ballad times. And although the talk really, if you checked it out, it has rhyme and it has rhythm. Really, sometimes the poet does rhyme for himself. So he's bound to a kind of, or she's bound to a kind of a form. And that's what this is. And this has to do with, this is me just thinking really hard about enfleshment, incarnation, and B, Mary, again. Think about Mary a lot. Christus Rex, you have a head like a plug, stopping her life, unmoving, in bone and the birth canal. But when she leans and drives you, red with the blood of 9 months loving, plump into the world. Oh, Mary, did you mutter? Mother, did you cry? He came like any other, though farther from on high. Thick and sealed, your eyelids looked like bean seeds soaked, their seams about to burst. Your tongue, that quivering spoon, licks the night, striving to speak some word, but first, oh, Mary, did it seem his infant cry could magnify into that cosmic scream the man exhaled to die? By lamplight, two drops of pale milk gleam on your nipples, yours the flow, the hormones from your mother. Dark infant, hair as fine as silk enshrouds your skin, wet with the fluids your mother shed to shed you. Oh, what a close commingling of your essences. Did Jesus leave a tingling by his absence? Yes. Day one delights the flesh with sucking, sleeping, happy peeing, infant occupations. Day eight destroys the flesh with holy wounds and holy bleeding, Jews' initiation. Mary, they cut him then. He bled a crimson flood. Oh, did you see therein your bridegroom of the blood? Oh, Mary, you were there. How much eternity in time did heaven dare to let his mother see? My incarnation always means there's a medium somewhere. And if you wish, you know, think about Mary here, but think about those who carry the word in ways. Think about the woman who preaches, and who really preaches. And what does that mean first between her relationship and this deity whom she's carrying in a word that she's about to deliver to a congregation? How much of heaven? Oh, I like this. Calypso. Calypso. Baby in the basket, soon he take 5 biscuit. Break each one 1,000 times. What with all them pieces? Baby he named Jesus. Feeds them bellies good and kind.
Baby in the cradle, soon he take a ladle, give us sips of burnin'. Jesus, bleed that purple juice for thirsty people. Make them drunk, they feeling fine. Baby in a manger, cross-eyed, crawling stranger, reaching tiny hand to mine. Jesus, he my finger, snatch like washer ringer, break my knuckles, snap my spine, cause our long bones twist and twine, graft me branches on him vine, crush me grape to make some wine. God, oh God of mine. Baby in the crook, him mama's elbow, look how little he to do these things. Baby in the arm of devil, king of harm, killing him what's king of kings. Devil lay the baby down in the cold crib underground. What when dying's bind him bound? What the damn world all around? Jesus, snap them strings and fly on Easter wings. Come and hang our Christmas sings, eat some warm bread, drink some drinks, open holy offerings, bornings, breathings, perishings, and risings. Rise we all, singing songs we sing, fly from hell to highest thing, the feast in heaven's hall, the Father's festival. And one more.
I like this one. In the third part of this book, I decided to fool around with the whole issue of gold and frankincense and myrrh. Last week I talked about what I learned about myrrh. I've been rereading actually Ovid's Metamorphoses, which I recommend to you. He's a very good storyteller. And then I came upon this story. It's about book 8. A story of a woman whose name is Mira. Okay, oh. Is that it? No, that's wrong. Where does the H go?
R-R-H.
Is it R-R-H? Thank you. Only her name is R-R-H-A. And to me, suddenly, it was just like an open revelation of what to think about with these gifts. I was trying to think about gold, and I was thinking about frankincense and myrrh. Well, myrrh comes from this woman's name, Mira. And she was the son of the king on Cyprus, which is the same island, you know, that Barnabas comes from and that St. Paul and Barnabas went to. So this is kind of in the thinking of the people. This is a story that clings around Paphos. Mira's grandfather was Paphos, which is the city, of course, that Paul goes to, right? Mm-hmm. You all remember that? And Ovid is writing the story down just, decades before Jesus is born. So this is current, you know, when the Bible is being written. And so I think sometimes, how do these things work together? Well, here's the story. Her father, who was a king, introduced prostitution, ritual and religious prostitution into his land. And as Ovid writes the story about Mira, she is the daughter of the king. He again and again says what a horrible thing she wants. But she falls in love with her father. She falls in love with her father, and she just weeps and aches with love for him until a nurse of hers says, why don't you put on the white gown of a priestess and go into your father during this ritual period, which she does. And she is impregnated by him. And he finds out who it is and what's been going on, and he just explodes in fury. It's a hard life for everyone. But he explodes in fury, and he runs after his daughter to kill her. She leaps and runs, begging unto the gods that somehow or other the life inside of her be preserved. She runs all the way, believe it or not, to Gilead, where perhaps for her there is no bomb. And the gods grant her this, that as she is running, she begins to grow from her toes roots. Her nails pop apart and her toes become roots in the ground. And her legs wind together and become a trunk of a bush or a tree. And her great sorrow makes her bend over in the agony of what's going on and her sorrow for herself and her child, so that she really wants the bark to cover her. But she bends over like this as she does and cries out to others that this is the way it should be, because she's also overwhelmed with guilt at the whole act and so forth. But she can't stop crying. She can't stop crying. So that as she becomes this bush which is bent over, her tears come out all over from the leaves and from the bark itself. And then the baby that's in her grows 9 months until it splits open and is born. It splits from the bark and is born. And the naiads of the river take care of this baby, wash it, and bring it back to its mother. and they feed the baby on the mother's tears, which they gather by putting the goats to eat the leaves, and the tears stick to their beards, and this is myrrh. This is the myrrh that is brought to the Christ child, bearing our loss, bearing our sin, that which the Christ child takes. And as I said here, it recurs in John as that which washes his dead body and he leaves in the tomb. But here is gold, and my last. This line occurred, this first two lines occur to me. I almost want them to come between every line as it goes. This is gold. What does it have to do with myrrh? I don't know. I'm just letting you know how heavy some of these things are and what we leave at the cross or what Jesus carries and takes away. Here it is. Molten gold is the godly sun, and the Son of God my golden one. Gold for him, the first of three, 'tis what the boy became for me. Gold he grew and golden spoke, confounding scholars of the book. Gold he walked and golden was, emblazing envy and black lust. And greed loves gold, but greed despised the sunny judgment of his eyes. Gold he lived and golden died, when pride accomplished regicide. My golden prince went underground to tear the gates of Satan down, and rose this morning, he the light, and I the fleeing of the night. Golden eyes and golden brow, he is the king of heaven now, and he shall beam at heaven's gate, his mother to illuminate. One day I'll walk his golden town in shoes of silk and silver gowns. Molten gold is the godly sun, and the Son of God, my golden.